Dominican for Rick Kogan. Joining us live in the studio, staff reporter for the Chicago Tribune, Ron Grossman. Ron, thank you for being here. How are you, sir?
I am very fine, thank you.
Very good to hear. Going through your background, we have so much to talk about. Oh, my goodness. We are so similar. I studied history.
Mm-hmm.
I also studied architecture.
Did you really?
Not under someone who you did. let's start with that. You studied architecture with Mies van der Rohe.
Yes, I did.
What was that like?
You know, when you were a kid from Albany Park, growing up in an Ech bourgeois house, the idea of being with someone that great and someone that revered for the fineness of his architecture would have been overwhelming if I had the sense to realize that. Remember that he was world famous before he came back to Chicago. He set up the Institute there, and it was a kind of Taj Mahal to himself. And there I am in there drawing it and waiting for him to come around once a week, take a look at the drawing, puff on his cigar, and say, "Yeah, try another one." If I should get the Pulitzer Prize or the Nobel, it would be second to him saying, "Yeah, try another one."
That's hysterical. And you're how old at the time? 18?
Well, I'd been at Navy Pier right after high school, so I must have been just into my 20s.
Okay.
We were the first class in the drafting building that he built there.
I see. And this was before he went to IIT, right?
No, at IIT. No. At the University of Illinois, I studied with other people. He was at IIT when I got there.
I got it. Okay. Yeah. All right. Very cool. You have a BA and a PhD in history from the University of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
You have been a professor of history at Lake Forest College, Michigan State University, and the University of Nebraska. You've got a couple books to mention. The 1981 book, Guide to Chicago Neighborhoods. This is intriguing to me.
Because
there's so much going on there. They're so different, and there's so much history.
Oh, you bet. You bet. That's why I could never leave the city. Whenever you're bored, you just go out in another direction and find something you didn't know before.
Right.
I did that because we traveled in Europe a lot by that point. And the sophistication, this sounds like a plug for myself, the sophistication of the guides there compared to what was done in the United States at the time was really different. So I tried to make a guide that when you're going down the street, it tells you what to look at. And when you get home, what to read. Who else was there before you and what did they write about?
That's great. Very nice. The next year, 1982, you wrote Map of Ethnic Groups in Chicago. Kind of similar, but you delve into what in this particular book?
Who lives where? I followed up on a project that the city had for many years, where I think it would be like every 10, they would draw a map of who lives where. And then in the 60s, that didn't happen, I think because the politicians didn't want to say what was happening to the city. So I picked it up, and because I was teaching at the time, I had lots of free labor. The undergraduates who could go out and do my methodology, which was to count the number of bakeries, funeral homes, and delicatessens or their equivalent.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And you could also say, yeah, try it again to them.
Yes, exactly.
There you go.
Yes.
One that really, really strikes my fancy is your 2015 book, A Century of Progress, a photographic tour of the 1933-34 Chicago's World's Fair. That had to be fun to write as well.
Yes, especially because I was there the second year. I was less than 1 year old, but my parents swear they took me there. So it was kind of a return to home.
There you go. That's great. We were talking before we went on air. I wrote a paper about that World's Fair, and I was a lifeguard at 12th Street Beach.
So oh.
The similarities are incredible. All right. We're going to get into this character because it was 135 years ago yesterday, July 10th, 1886, that this story all started. Former Mississippi riverboat captain and circus owner George Wellington Cap Streeter ran his steamboat, 35-ton Rutan, onto a sandbar near the foot of Superior Street. He couldn't move the vessel, It slowly silted into place. Streeter claimed it made up the independent United States District of Lake Michigan.
Spelled with two E's as the vowel.
Yes.
District.
Yes. And he repeated that in court.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. The question is, did a storm really blow him off course there? Probably not. Did he do it deliberately? Yes. Did he actually run a steamboat on the Mississippi River? Opinions vary on that way. He was a tremendous self-promoter. The other story he used to give out is that he and his wife, known to historians as Ma Streeter, planned to take that boat and run guns to Latin America. And then they looked at a map and saw, gee, it's a long way from here to Latin America. So they said, well, let's just do tours here. And they did excursion tours between Chicago and Milwaukee before they came up with this idea.
Okay. You wrote an article about him a few years ago, 2014, mm-hmm. or 16. January 1st, the 16th. I brought it up because it was 135 years ago yesterday. I was checking that out, and I'm like, who can I get to talk to about this? And your name popped up because you know all about this guy. Unbridled chutzpah is what he's been known for.
Yes.
Right? And the term squatter's rights. He wouldn't leave.
No, he claimed that when the thing happened, a guy by the name of Fairbanks, who lived right on the shore, gave him permission to stay until the boat could be fixed. Who knows if it was broken. So he just decided to stay and stay and stay. And then had the idea that if people would just throw trash around his boat, it would accumulate into land. In fact, since the Chicago fire, Chicagoans have been dumping their stuff right there. So he just said, come by my house, so to speak. And it began to build up, and that's what's the neighborhood of Streeterville right now. At a certain point, the residents on the lakeshore, which was at this point inland from Lakeshore Drive, or Jean-Baptiste Pont de Sable Lakeshore Drive, They didn't think that was a good thing, and they tried to get him out. Well, it took decades to do. He kept coming up with reasons why that was his. The one I like best is he got some kind of document saying that, I forget which president was, signed something to somebody who gave the thing to him. Well, when that one got to court, they got experts on handwriting who found that underneath the fake signature was another president's signature, and that the original letters were something else totally different.
So he just kept doing this. He kept going to court.
Yeah.
And defending this.
And also fighting land battles, too. As the land piled up, the reclaimed land piled up. I don't know what we call them, marginal types. Colorful types joined him up there. He wanted to sell lots there. I don't know how many he actually got sold. But he sold small lots out there. And besides those who bought, so-called squatters just came out there. So it became a center of prostitution and booze on Sunday, both of which are strictly speaking against the law. And every once in a while, the people on the shore would mount an invasion of his space, and the marginal types would come out with their shotguns, and he and Ma would come out with theirs, and they'd drive the officers of law off, and the whole thing would start over again.
And the court battles never went anywhere. Why was that? I mean, he's got no right to this, but he just sold it?
Evidently, the original plan was not to sell small lots, but to tell the people on Lakeshore, take a look at us. You want us bums out here and sell to them at a high price. They resisted, and this is what happened. I don't know why the courts were so lenient with him. At one point, he was convicted of murder. He shot somebody in one of those forays.
Right.
And I think did a year or two in prison. But there it was. Year after year after year. Now, incidentally, while he welcomed the lowlifes there, he himself didn't want to live next to them. He rented a room in a Tremont Hotel, then one of the finest ones in town.
It just keeps getting better and better.
Yep.
Now, this is the area. The Tremont Hotel is right by where the Hancock Building
is. That's exactly.
And this is prime real estate.
Yep. The man was a farseer.
Yeah. Mm. And of course, it's called Streeterville. Now, after him, just because he's such a colorful character and a true Chicagoan, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, the idea of creating your own persona, that's Chicago to the core.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you know about Dr. Ivey?
No.
He was the vice president for research of the University of Illinois. This would have been in the late 40s or 50s. And he had some noble accomplishments. But, you know, everybody runs out of ideas. And a Yugoslav doctor came to him and said, I have a cure for cancer. And Dr. Ivey said, well, what is it? He said, I make it out of horses that I infect with a mysterious disease.
What?
That went on for years. For years, Ivy lost his job after a while. The university first backed him and then thought this is just terrible kind of publicity. So they kicked him out, and I think he set up another lab at the University of at Roosevelt University and private agencies where he dispensed this cure, putatively made from horses who've been infected with something. But in fact, when it finally got analyzed by a court order, it turned out to be a chemical which is fairly common in the human body, doesn't cure anything, and is worthless.
The scams. We're talking with Ron Grossman. He writes for the Chicago Tribune about all things Chicago. We're going to talk about a couple of things in just a little bit. White City, which grew out of another World's Fair that was in Chicago. Any more books in the works as of right now?
Not right now. I don't know how to phrase this. We're quite busy at the Tribune these days, those of us who remain.
Well, yeah, we could talk for hours about that. Yeah. And we're glad you're still there, by the way.
Thank you. If and when I retire, yeah, I would like to do books, yeah.
Okay. Any topics? Chicago-based, of course, right?
Yeah, probably so. Probably so. If you string together the colorful characters, you don't have to put much of the detail in between them.
It pretty much writes itself now, doesn't it?
Yep. You know about Leo Corret?
No. I got about a minute. Talk to me about him.
Leo Corret went to law school. He had a practice that was floundering. So he went into speculation of land in other countries, which he didn't own, but that didn't stop him from selling it. Because he was Jewish and came from a respectable family, he sold lots of families the land that he didn't own. When that came down, he fled to Canada, reinvented himself as a patron of the literature, waiving one book review he'd done for something, and pulled the same thing off there.
Wow.
You see what I mean? The book writes itself.
It's right there, exactly. We're talking with Ron Grossman of the Chicago Tribune. We're talking with Ron Grossman live in the studio. He's with the Chicago Tribune. This music we're listening to is by Pete Townsend. The song is Face the Face from the album White City. And I chose that for a reason, because we're going to discuss that in just a little bit. Rick, thank you for joining us once again. Glad you're with us. Or Ron. A little background on the World's Fair, because this is where White City grew out of. Okay? The first American World's Fair, it was in Philadelphia in 1876. There were people there, but it was a financial failure. Ideas about discussing the 400th anniversary of Columbus's landing, that started in the 1880s. People in St. Louis, New York City, Washington, D.C., and Chicago wanted to host the fair for profits, boost real estate values, the whole nine yards, promote their cities as well. New York had a bunch of money. They pledged $15 million. This is $15 million right around 1893. That's a lot of money. And it came from the people who you would know and expect this from in New York: J.P. Morgan, Vanderbilt, William Waldorf Astor, and others. So they had $15 million. Chicagoans Charles T. Yerkes, Marshall Field, Philip Armour, Gustavus Swift, Cyrus McCormick, they wanted to finance the Chicago Fair. The thing that kind of set it off was Chicago banker Lyman Gage. He raised $7 million additional dollars in like a 24-hour period, and it surpassed New York's final offer. So the 1893 World's Columbian Edition was here in Chicago. And this is in Hyde Park area, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where the museum is right now.
And the University of Chicago.
Right. Yes, exactly. So the 1893 World's Columbian Exposition, it ran from May through October of 1893. 46 nations participated in the fair. It was the first World's Fair to have national pavilions. And it drew over 27 million visitors. So this was pretty successful.
Yep.
Now, some notable firsts that happened at this fair in 1893, the World's Columbian Exposition here in Chicago. Cream of wheat. The brownie was invented by Bertha Palmer. That debuted at the fair. Milton Hershey added chocolate products to his caramel manufacturing business. Juicy fruit gum made its debut. Quaker oats, shredded wheat, Pabst Blue Ribbon beer first appeared at the 1893 World's Fair here in Chicago. Peanut butter, Aunt Jemima pancake mix, Vienna sausage, soon to become Vienna beef. They sold hot dogs, frankfurter, sausages near the entrances to the Midway. Printable books in Braille. Helen Keller was at the exhibit, and the device that did that. A moving walkway, the third rail giving electric power to elevated trains debuted. The forerunner to the zipper, it was called the clasp locker. It was a slide fastener that was demonstrated at the fair. The squashed penny, elongated coins. So many things that first debuted there. I'm trying to paint the picture of how successful this was. So it was there. It was successful. It closed down. And then it took a while for White City to become about. Ron, what happened with White City? How did that come about?
There was another hustler by the name of Aaron Jones.
Wait. A hustler in Chicago. Really?
Yeah, it's amazing. Incidentally, Charles Yerkes, who put up some of the money for New York, was also a Chicago swindler. He built some of the L's. And his motto was, that somebody asked him, how do you do it, make your money? He said, you buy something cheap, paint it up, and sell it to some sucker.
There you go.
Could be a T-shirt.
Well, it worked.
But Alan Jones was a hustler. He ran Nickelodeons, that is, cheap theaters for the first of the movies, and penny arcades. And he was out on the south side one day looking at a cornfield. Remember, the city was very new then. Roughly at Dr. Martin Luther King Drive and 63rd Street.
Okay.
And on top of them is the L, the first L that went out there. And he said to himself, there's transportation to this site. We can make it into a fair, but strip away the heavy stuff. If you think about the 93 World Fair, it was science, the arts, fun and game, and tawdry girly shows. And he said, you know, I'm a businessman. Let's get rid of the first stuff and do the second stuff.
Right.
He had one of his arcades in the Stevens Hotel, and the owner of that came with the money to do the thing together. His name was Joseph Byfield. And together they got enough money to buy the land and to sell concessions there. And it's called an amusement park, but it's not like the ones today. We think of it as amusement park is they have the rides and maybe a few other things. They had that plus all kinds of shows. Buffalo Bill was there one time with his Wild West. They burnt the city down in replica twice a day. Just the actors for the burning of the city were 2,000 people.
I read that in your article. That's incredible.
As I finished the article, my wife looked over it, and we both decided, why were we born too late to see this thing?
I see a theme in your writing, and I couldn't agree with you more, where this was just such a fascinating time.
Oh, you bet.
The centerpiece of the White City Amusement Park was this 300-foot tower, right? It was lined with 20,000 electric light bulbs.
And every other building as well. It is rumored or said that the total number of electric light bulbs was 1 million.
Whoa.
If they hadn't or didn't borrow the city, the name White City from the fair, it just looked like that. You could see that tower 15 miles away.
That's incredible. And another interesting thing was infant incubators.
Yeah.
What about that?
The incubator was around, but hospitals and doctors were very conservative at the time. And so they had no part in it. They didn't want them. But there was a promoter, another kind of Chicago guy, who called himself Dr. something, but he didn't have a degree.
Wait, what?
He didn't have a degree. He was, I think he was German-born or Belgian, and he wound up here, and he thought the incubators were a good thing. He didn't want to test the degree by going into hospital work, even if they take them. So he created a roadshow and would take a hospital ward, as it were, to the fair here and to other fairs around the country, and advertised that premature babies, mothers, please bring them here. I'll save them for you.
Wow.
Now, on the one hand, it sounds exploitative, but there was no other resource.
Yeah. We're talking with Ron Grossman of the Chicago Tribune. Ron, we got about a minute left. What is in the future for you? What can we look forward to? You mentioned you were working on this article for the Trib. What's that about?
Next week is... my mind isn't working. It's the Green Book.
Okay.
The Green Book was in the bad old days of segregation. People of color who wanted to travel in the United States had a real problem because many places there was nobody who would serve them, nobody who would put them up overnight, and gas stations who wouldn't let them use them. So a New York postman had the idea of creating a guide called the Negro Motorist Green Book to where people could get service. And it went from the late 30s all the way to 1964.
Wow.
And it allowed people of color to experience at least a taste of freedom.
Interesting. And when can we expect that article?
Either next week or the week after that.
We look forward to seeing that.
Thank you.
Ron Grossman, thank you so much for joining us, sir. Thank you for sharing your stories with us. We look forward to another book when you're ready, and continue.